Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. My name's Gary Thacker, and we're back with another episode in Series 2 of Mount Rushmore. It's a series where we ask invited guests to select their four players, one goalkeeper, one defender, one midfielder, and one forward, who they believe deserve to be immortalised on their club's own Mount Rushmore monument. It's not necessarily about the best players, the longest serving, top goal scorer. It's for each guest to decide on the players that they think are the most deserving and worthy of the acclaim of being on Mount Rushmore. Before we introduce today's guest, though, I'm just going to introduce my co-host today, just on his own today, with our other guy absent to a medical problem. Aidan, how you doing, buddy?
Evening, Gary. Yes, looking forward to another excellent episode, as ever. Another fine club to get into. They're on their up at the minute. But they've had their downs too, and I'm sure we'll get into plenty of the characters who've gone along the way with them in this. And that's always the joy, is discovering new stories that aren't necessarily the ones that are more familiar.
Dead right, buddy, dead right. Okay, so today's guest is Michael Hamblin. Michael runs the 80s and 90s football page on Twitter, which he can tell us more about in a moment. He appreciates football from all over the world and has extensive knowledge of international, European and domestic football. For his team, the team we're going to discuss today, is Brighton and Hove Albion. He laments that he grew up in an area when Brighton were in decline and nearly went out of the Football League in 1997. But as Aidan mentioned, things looking up much brighter now. So welcome on board, Michael. Tell us a little bit about yourself and why Brighton.
Yes, thank you. Delighted to be here. Thank you much. About the page. I've got about the page first. It's basically about just remembering a time when I think football's better. I think that's basically because that's when I was a kid and I was growing up. So you always think football's better then because you've got no bills, you've got no family concerns or anything to worry about. So we literally every day just post goals, players, teams, memorabilia, put polls out occasionally, obviously do some writing, do quizzes, interact with people from all over the world. Try and incorporate every club, try not to be biased. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I enjoy it, and I hope everyone else does who listens or follows the page.
Yeah, I understand you've done some podcasts in the past as well, Michael.
Yeah, I've done a few guest appearances, I like to call it. So I've done been on the H2O football, and we did a hypothetical one about naming an England team that didn't get enough caps in the 90s. Been on the Armchair Fanatic, talked about Yugoslavia in the 90s. And talked about the Soviet Union in the 80s and 90s. Talked a bit about the politics and the backdrop, but mainly about football. And done a couple on the For the Love of List as well. And recently did a top 10 Argentinian football players, which was quite a fun one to do.
Yeah, that's a pretty eclectic sort of interest in various sides across the world. So why Brighton? Are you a local boy?
Yeah, well, I grew up and I still live in the same town, which is about 3-4 miles away from the old Goldstone Ground in Hove. So geographically, it's my team. Dad, he's a season ticket holder at the Amex, and he's been going since the late 60s and 70s. So I didn't really have much of a choice. But as you mentioned in the introduction there, when I first started getting into football, my first game was in 1988, and we were in the second division. And at that time, when you're 8 and you're 9 and you start buying sticker books and you buy magazines and you're getting videos, in those days they were Fox videos of Race for the Championship, my team weren't on it. So I think this is where I start getting this extensive knowledge of mine of other clubs and other players from around the world, and obviously in England. And then Italia 90 happened, and then I got the whole sort of plethora of knowledge from reading the ring binders and the sticker books. So almost, I was thinking about this, almost like my football journey is almost on two parallels. So you've got my club and you've got everything else. And at the moment, they've pretty much converged together.
Yeah. It's interesting, Aidan, that when you start supporting a football club and sometimes, you know, you support them. I suppose a lot of fans, when they're coming to supporting football, they tend to follow successful clubs unless it's there's another reason to have your local club or it's a family link or some other link. But when, as Michael says, when you sort of start supporting Brighton, they were struggling. But things are definitely on the up for the club now.
Oh, very much so. I mean, Michael's talking there about, obviously runs this 80s and 90s Twitter feed, which just to point out, as an impartial judge, I think it's excellent. So well worth a follow from everybody who's listening to this. Brighton, you know, they've had peaks and troughs, as we say. They forced their way into my childhood awareness in the 1983 FA Cup final. Of course, you know, one of my early FA Cup final memories is on the bus travelling to Wembley with Brighton players, as it was in the day. You know, when you watch the whole thing all day long. So the team from those days had a host of famous names, but not necessarily means they're the one that resonates most with Michael, of course. Then more recently, I guess they travelled down through the divisions, but they came up again, and there was Gus Poyet's time, which was always seemed quite fun. Although they always beat my team, Newcastle United, they always seem to get one over on us. And now, of course, so well regarded with a forward-thinking manager, Graham Potter, who is much coveted by others. And it's good, though, as you say, to have these connections in terms of, it doesn't have to be local, you know, it's some sort of connection. In this case, it's local. But for that bond to sort of stay through all the down times that happen in between the peaks is, I guess, the true test of of loyalty and fandom or of love and the bond that's been forged. And it doesn't need a peak for that bond to be forged. It just needs time and care and attention, I guess, and being exposed to something as a child, of going along to games or just following them in by whatever means possible through talking with family or friends at school or whatever it is. The bonds get stronger and stronger that way. And it's all the better when those bonds aren't with some hugely successful club from far away. You know, local people to these hugely successful clubs have a different kind of bond, and that's great. Those who just latch onto the success for no other reason other than the fact that they're successful, that always sticks in the craw for everybody else, doesn't it? So in these cases, it's pleasing to see that this bond has been forged strongly through childhood and has remained true today. And Michael is wearing his Brighton and Hove Albion hoodie, which is perfect. So that just shows that, you know, this is no harking back just to his youth. This is a current thing as well, which is great.
Yeah, and reaping the rewards now for the hard years you spent earlier. So okay, Michael, let's get the ball out, as I say, and have a kick around. So we're going to start with goalkeepers. So before you tell us who you chose, tell me who came close. Who was sort of, you know, near misses?
Well, I've got four on here, so I won't go into great deal of detail. But the first one you've got is Graham Mosley, goalkeeper in the first division when we were in there in the early 80s. Was obviously in the cup final. Really, really decent keeper. He's made a fantastic double save. Against Sheffield Wednesday in the FA Cup semi-final at Highbury, which, funny enough, I posted on the page actually not that long ago. But unfortunately, it's just before my time, so I've only seen him on clips. So I think he probably is. He should be up there, but for me, I didn't see him. And then I looked at Perry Digweed. You know, he was an understudy all throughout the 1980s. Didn't actually play many games, but he sort of stayed at the club. And then he got his chance after John Keeley left. Really good shot stopper. And he was wearing tracksuit trousers in goal before Dimitri Kyrene was. There were goalies that played at the on plastic pitches, but he used to wear them at the Goldstone in the mud. So I always remember that. It seems silly to remember that, but I always remember, you know, that. And then going to the other end of the sort of spectrum of my sort of supporting the club, you know, we had Thomas Kuszczak, who came, you know, played for West Brom, you know, Man United, Polish international goalkeeper, and all of a sudden it was like, wow, we've really signed a top keeper here. And David Stockdale, I think from that season we got promoted, was outstanding. you know, he played for Fulham. You know, Capello had called him up for the England team before. I know he'd never played, but he was a good goalie. But the goalie I've gone for, and he's not as good as these other goalies, I'll be honest, is Michel Kuipers. And there's, I think I'll cover through the reasons, but, you know, he's a former Dutch Marine. We signed him from Bristol Rovers. He played at the Wydad team between 2000 and 2010, so he never got to play at the MX. Technically, he wasn't the best goalie. He couldn't kick a ball very well. I think the one game he got subbed off at half-time because his kicking was that bad. But he had really good reactions, was a really good shot stopper. But he suffered really horrific injuries and a really bad car crash in 2003 and had a really bad shoulder injury in 2005. But I've chosen him just because the amount of goalies that Brighton bought or signed on loan throughout that 10 years to replace him, and he kept coming back and he kept regaining his place in the team. And you think, well, for the tenacity and for the sort of dedication to keep going and keep coming back, I think is worthy of a shout. And I think that's the reason I've gone for him. That's it. One other thing to mention, he's probably most famous, or I'm remembering most, the saving penalty against Man City in the League Cup when they'd just been bought out by after takeover. So they're the richest team in the world, playing at the Amex, at the Athletic Track, getting changed in the porter cabin. And we beat him in the penalty shootout and he saved from Michael Ball. And that was all the fans are running on the pitch, and that was a real magic moment. That was.
That's fair. It's interesting that, you know, you've gone through a few more than decent goalkeepers. And the only one I was going to add is the only one I've got on my little list here that you didn't know is Matty Ryan. Obviously, he played a season before he moved on to Arsenal. But there's certainly a few that it's interesting that, you know, this is a theme we sort of hear time and time again, that the players that people pick are the ones that they seem to have given their all for the club and, you know, fought against adversity and that sort of thing. What do you think, Aidan?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on there. And I think looking into Michael Kuipers and what I've discovered about him in researching for this, I think his character, as well as the sort of tenacity and kept regaining his place that Michael's talking about there in terms of on the football side. But I mean, his personality, character as well is what appeals to people. I think he seems to have been quite an outgoing character, very passionate, as well as being a superb shot stopper and goalkeeper. I think people like that often appeal to fans. I mean, they draw attention to themselves, but in a positive way, particularly for fans of that club. They sort of act in some small way, a little bit like the fans do, I think, and that's why it's easy to relate in certain ways. You know, if you see a player fist pumping or celebrating, in his case, a good save or a chance prevented, that's the same reaction that we have watching on. It's exactly the same reaction that those fans just behind him in the stand will be having. So you build up that sort of kinship. He displays the same feelings and emotions. You gain that level of understanding, shared understanding, and like you're in it together. And I think that's what that sort of adds to the bond and connection. So it, as you say, Michael has laid out there that Michel Kuipers was not as good as several of the others that he's talking about. But that doesn't matter in this case. It's more about that connection, that bond, the longevity in his case, the fact that they kept trying to replace him and he just said, no, I'm going to keep improving and make sure that you can't drop me or get rid of me because I'm going to keep proving my worth again and again and again. Now, Michael talked there about famous penalty shootout saves. I think he had a couple of those. Not just the Man City one, I think there might have been another one too, but equally he's well regarded for an incredible double save that I was watching earlier today on YouTube against Wolves. And this is absolutely remarkable. The first save was good enough, the second was even better, but I think what topped it off is that then he kind of rolls nonchalantly over after this spectacular second save and just catches the ball as it drops out of the air straight into his hands as though it was the simplest thing in the world. And he was just catching a ball that he'd just lobbed upwards himself. And I think as good as the double save was, it's that moment at the end, I think, that sort of makes it so iconic. I think without that, it would have just it would have just been a magnificent double save. Brilliant in itself. But that little moment at the end, I think that just makes it absolutely brilliant. So YouTube Klaxon, you should go and hunt that one out because it's absolutely fantastic. And it's little moments like that from some of the things I've been reading. That's an incident, a double save that, you know, it's still noted. It used to be played on the big screens at the Amex before games as part of the G'ing the crowd up. So penalty shootout heroics against Manchester City are incredible. And so are these kind of saves as well. And it's all these incidents helped to build the myth and legend. Add that on to a character who's so outgoing, acts in the way a fan does at times.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I was doing a little research myself this morning. And, I got onto a couple of Brighton fan forums, and one that got their best Brighton team of the 2000s, and Kuipers was chosen the goalkeeper, and the six best players. I don't think it was from 2000, but it was fairly recent. And Kuipers was in that as well. So, I mean, you know, Michael's not on his own as writing this goalkeeper as the guy most deserving to go on Mount Rushmore. And it's interesting about, you know, with goalkeepers, and perhaps the only other category we're fitting into this would be forwards, where there are moments, like you just described there, I'd like Michael described about the penalty save against Man City. These are moments that sort of stick in your mind, and they sort of, you know, they lock into almost the character of the player as much as his ability. So, yeah, are you happy with that choice then, Michael? Shall we sort of ink him in for Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, definitely happy with that one.
Okay, buddy. So, Michael Kuipers, that's the first guy we're going to go with. So, we're moving away from the out of the nets and put the gloves down, and we're going to move on to defenders. So, don't tell us who chose them yet. We'll come back to it in a second. But just tell us who's coming close with defenders, because there's plenty to go out from Brighton from what I found out this morning.
Yeah, there's a few. And I think the first one, obviously, that sprung to mind instantly was Mark Lawrenson. You know, he obviously left for Liverpool and, you know, formed a great partnership with Hansen and wins multiple league titles, the European Cup in 84. And, you know, if you talk to anyone of my dad's age, and they'd all say that he's like the best defender, you know, that they've seen. But unfortunately, I never saw him play for the club. And it's a bit like sort of Steve Foster as well, that I thought of him, you know, great player at that era as well. You know, he won three caps for England while he was at Brighton and went to the 82 World Cup. And famously suspended for the 83 Cup final, where we drew 2-2, and he came back and we lost 4-0. So what does that say? Maybe that's why he's not being picked. But he came back to the club after he'd been to Oxford and Luton, sort of 92, and wound his career down. So I did see him at the tail end of his career with the old famous headband, and anything that was thrown into the box, he always cleared it with his head. I thought about him, and I also come across Danny Culliff as well. He was a real cult hero around that early 15 years. You know, we had promotion in 2001, 2002, and then got relegated in 2003 and was in playoff in 2004. That was quite an event for a few years, that was. And then I think the next one I came across, and I think if I did this in maybe a few years' time, I think I probably would be choosing him, and that would be Lewis Dunk. I think, you know, one-man club, he's played there, you know, since the With Dean. You know, I think if you watch Match of the Day every Saturday, I reckon he probably gets the most blocks each week. He throws his life on the line every single game. And, you know, he's only got one international cap, which I know is a bit of a bone of contention down the South Coast, but he's good on the ball. He's not blessed with pace, but he's got great positioning. But the guy that I've gone for, and this completely bucks the trend where you always have picked centre-backs in this, and I haven't gone for a centre-back. I've gone for a right back, and
don't tell us his name yet. Don't tell us his name yet.
Let's, right.
We'll just have a look at the name issues first. Then I've got a few more names to add that I've sort of looked up as well. But I remember the Steve Foster missing that cup final, and Tony Grealish, I think it was, wore Foster's headband, didn't he, as they walked from the pitch, sort of like sort of tribute to him. Shane Duffy, I think, would probably sort of. There or thereabouts, and perhaps not the traversers, but there or thereabouts, and Gordon Greer, perhaps.
Yeah,
Kerry Mayo, perhaps.
Yeah.
Perhaps there or thereabouts. Just these were sort of players I sort of saw when I was researching this morning. So, Aidan, what do you think about those near misses? I mean, that was a bad centre back partnership. Steve Foster and Mark Lawrenson.
I know. I mean, yeah, exactly. The early '80s, they had some real quality, and obviously, they're the names that sprung to my mind, but it's obviously slightly before Michael's time. So that explains why they missed out. Because I think in terms of quality, you wouldn't be able to beat those. I think Steve Foster winning those England caps whilst at Brighton sort of would, in my mind, elevate him beyond Lawrenson, I think, because his best years obviously came elsewhere. The one I'd looked into a bit was Danny Cullip, and I think it's good Michael mentioned him, because I think he has the sort of characteristics, again, different in the way to we've been talking about Kuipers there in goal, but he has other characteristics that fans often latch onto in terms of the sort of never say die type of attitude, you know, no nonsense defending, a little more, less cultured than some perhaps, but, you know, effective in a way that is easier to relate to. And that definitely always appeals. So it's good to see him get a mention because he's obviously come through the leagues a little bit with them and helped them on their way. I guess there's other famous names back from the 80s as well as Gary Stevens, the non-Everton Gary Stevens, the one who went to Tottenham and ended up at the World Cup as well. He was another one from that team in the early 80s in the FA Cup. But, you know, those famous names there, if they fall before your time, they're not going to make the cut so easily, are they? Unless they're of such legendary status that it's impossible to ignore. And then it's based, but that's more based on stories being passed down and things like that, isn't it? And looking other things up. That's not quite the way that fandom works. So, you know, I think we're going to get a good story from the one he has picked.
I think we are. Yeah. I mean, as Mark alluded to, quite often we get centre backs chosen in this category, but this guy's in centre back. So tell us a bit about your choice then, Michael.
Well, I know, I nearly spoiled it, didn't I? So anyway, we've gone for Bruno. So Bruno Salter, simply known as Bruno, or in Brighton, he's known as El Capitan. Fantastic player. As I said, he's not a centre back, but within his seven seasons, become an absolute club legend. You know, he signed at 31 from Valencia, so you're probably thinking, you know, he's come to maybe not so much wind his career down, but you don't expect to get 7 years out of him at that age. He was still playing at the Premier League at the age of 38. Fantastic pro, on and off the pitch, technically brilliant. You know, I used to sort of, you know, sit in the West End, and you see him on the right, and he'll get the ball will come to him in the real, real tight sort of spaces. He'll have someone on him, but he'd never lose it. He'd always play it simple. He'd either make the other player look silly, and he'd make himself available all the time, and he'd make little runs, and was a great leader. Was just an absolutely brilliant player. You know, he's adopted Brighton as his home. He still works for the club now. He was great off the pitch, the charity work, having in the community. I've said it once or twice here, he's just a brilliant, brilliant player. And I think that, as I said, you normally pick centre-backs, or other people normally pick centre-backs. But for me, I think on and off the pitch is what makes him stand out for me.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I would have gone for this guy as well. Inspirational leader, isn't he? I mean, as well as being a more than decent player, and there's a mural on the wall I've seen with his features. I mean, very distinctive face with this sort of shaved head and beard. It's just El Capitan, obviously an inspirational player. Aiden, what do you think about Bruno?
Yeah, I think...
Not Frank Bruno.
Well, if you say Bruno to a Newcastle fan, that means somebody else these days as well, of course.
Yes.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head, Gary, there about the look. He has a certain look about him, and I think that adds to the appeal, as well as his undoubted quality, which obviously helps too. But I think the sort of shaved head with lack of hair, the big dark beard. It's not just, you know, not just your run-of-the-mill stubbly beard. This is a proper man's beard. You know, this is real stuff. Plus, of course, the tan skin of a Mediterranean to make him look slightly more sophisticated than the rest of us as well. But I think that the overall look, it gave him a sort of mean, stern appearance. And, you know, that's not necessarily how he played, but he sort of looked like the kind of guy you wouldn't want to try and get the better of down the wing. If you're opposing him, he obviously took quite a risk, I think, well, the club did too, of obviously going for somebody of this age. And for him, it was a bit of a risk to go out of Familia, where he'd been obviously in Spain for so long, 120-odd games in La Liga. You know, this is a quality player we're talking about here. Moving at 31 or 32, thereabouts, to a new country, something he didn't know much about, couldn't speak the language at the time, and all this kind of stuff. It's quite a culture shock. And I think in terms of footballing style, there was probably a culture shock as well at the time. But there was this kind of growing Spanish contingent at that point, I think, at least in the year or two following his arrival as well. It kind of grew. There was Gus Poyet. I know he's not Spanish, but obviously there's the Latin influence and the common language there, which probably helped on all of those regards. And I think he's the kind of player whose quality just shows through. You get players who sort of move to a different scenery, new change of scenery in their later years of their career. And I think he's a perfect example of the type of player who can flourish in that environment. So maybe he wasn't quite at the level that he could forge another 3-4 years at the top level of La Liga. You know, he could probably drop down a bit in Spain or a lower La Liga team. But, you know, to branch out and go for a new experience is really, really admirable. And to then see that experience enable you to flourish again, a sort of a second flourish, if you like, in a totally different environment and a totally different way, it's really quite pleasing in a way. And it's the kind of it's the obvious bond that he's forged with the city, and I think that, or town, is it? Sorry, I may have misspoke there. But either way, the bond he's forged with Brighton, that's clear in what Michael's saying there about how he's sort of grown to love the place and he's still involved with the club now. I think that's really, it's kind of heartening in a way. It's pleasing, isn't it? And it adds to the appeal for the fans to know that, you know, your home, the place you've always belonged to or felt a belonging to, somebody from outside comes in, feels the love of fans, the club, and the place, and then reciprocates that connection back in terms of the place, not just the club. I think that elevates things another level when outsiders, whatever definition of outsiders that is, that doesn't have to be foreign, that could be from just a different part of the country, fall in love and want to stay in an area that they've played in, effectively had a job in to think of it in the terms of the rest of us. So I think that really adds to the appeal. His undoubted quality clearly adds to the appeal too. You know, he's helped Brighton to promotion and stayed on for a little bit extra in the Premier League as well. When he retired, his words on retiring was, once a seagull, always a seagull. And there you go. I think that just cements the bond.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you mentioned Valencia Camp just down the road from me here in Spain. And to move at that age, I mean, there must have been sort of cynical views of the transfer, saying he's a guy who's just coming for a last payoff. He'll be there for 18 months and then, but no, this guy was fully committed to the club, and you know, he took the club and the city to his heart, and I think the fans obviously took him to their heart. So I guess he's a massively popular figure in Brighton, Michael, is that correct?
Oh, definitely.
Okay, so there's no doubt, and I think that's a great choice. We're going to, Bruno's going to be on there, but this guy's hard as nails, so I might blunt a few chisels while I'm chipping away at the mountain there, but we'll keep at it. And so we're going to move to midfield now. Before we go to the choice, this is a fascinating choice that Michael's gone with. Let's look at some of the alternatives, Michael, first. Who came closer?
Well, the one that I feel really, really bad about is Brian Houghton. You know, I've interacted with him on Twitter and I feel really bad that I'm not choosing him. You know, captain in 79, you know, when we got promoted and we won 3-1 at St. James's Park. Sorry, Aidan. And you know, we're, you know, really, really tough player. You know, he could play a bit. He was a great captain. He was really, really good at team bonding in that period as well. But unfortunately, I never saw him play. Jimmy Case, another one, very similar. You know, he came the other way when Lawrenson went into Liverpool, was part of like, sort of a sweetener almost, part of the deal. Another fantastic player. He won everything at Liverpool in the 70s. Another tough player, proper player. He could score goals. He could tackle. He could do everything. He scores one of my favourite Brighton goals, fun enough, against Sheffield Wednesday at Highbury in the 83 semi-final, where he lashes it and it goes in off the bar, and it's absolutely fantastic goal. And he came back in 93 after playing for Southampton in between, and became a manager, but the club was in a really bad place at the time. So I feel really, really bad for not including those two. And I looked then at another sort of more modern player of the with Dean era, and that was Charlie Oatway, another player who was, you know, famously named after the whole of the 1973 QPR title winning team. I'm not going to go through all his 12 names or 11 names, but he was another tough tackling midfielder, terrier almost. You know, he's always up for the fight and the calls, and he signed for Brentford, same time as Cullip actually. And again, was there, you know, the two promotions and obviously the relegation. And I looked at Antti Knockaert, and I think of all those times, the joy that I've had in the last, you know, those seasons going up towards the Premier League, you know, Wolves, and, you know, the commentary on the radio at the time. You know, and they used to call him, you know, box office is what they called him, because he's one of those players that, to me, he's too good for the Championship, but he's not good enough for the Premier League. You know, he's fantastic in the Championship with the way he makes defenders look stupid, and then you put him in the Premier League and he gets found out. And I nearly chose him, but I'll stop now before I go and I ruin who I've chosen.
Good timing, Michael. Good timing. Yeah, I mean, I can't always remember him for a bad memory from your point of view, the penalty, Watford, and then, you know, missed the penalty and promotion slipped away. And the whole season just seems so cruel. The whole season's work is gone in split seconds. So I always took my mind for that. A couple of names I've got down as well. Dal Stevens, I thought would be sort of, you know, where they mention it, and Inigo Calderon, who's perhaps not too dissimilar from the guy you actually have chosen. So before we got on to Michael's choice, any thoughts on the midfield positions there, Aidan?
Yeah, when I was thinking about it earlier, Jimmy Case was the one that sprung to mind for me, because, yeah, that famous goal that Michael's described brilliantly there of the FA Cup semi-final. But, you know, again, this fits the category I mentioned earlier about the defenders. It's, if it's slightly before the time of your real awareness, so Michael's saying it's his favourite goal, so there must be some awareness, but not quite to the same extent as those you've actually experienced properly in the flesh. He was the obvious other choice in my mind that sort of leapt to mind. I like the Antti Knockaert thing, though, about too good for the Championship and not good enough for the Premier League. There's quite a few players in that category. You know, you think of the likes of Alexander Mitrovic at the minute. The season he's just had at Fulham, he's had several goes in the Premier League with Newcastle as well as Fulham. And, you know, it's never quite the same, but maybe it will be now. Maybe it'll be different after the incredible feats he's had this year. I think of players like Dwight Gale and so on, people like this, you know, they just aren't quite able to cut it. And yet you go down a level and they're too good for it. And it's an awful place to be. In club terms, Norwich City, I guess, are the example of exactly the same on a slightly wider scale. It's, yeah, you know, things will change and cycles will run and you know, things will alter there. But it's an interesting position to be in. It must be incredibly frustrating for somebody like Antti Knockaert, because you know that you really want the chance at the higher level. You get the chance at the higher level and it doesn't quite go as well as you'd hope. That's not to say he's still not a very good player by most means, but yeah, I think that the midfielder we're about to hear about, though, is better a better choice than Antti Knockaert, that's for sure. The Jimmy Case thing is totally understandable again because of the timing, but I think another YouTube klaxon, we should all go and see his free kick from that FA Cup semi-final in 1983.
Yeah, there again, not a bad midfield too. Would it be Brian Horton and Jimmy Case in the centre?
Well, I hope Brian Horton doesn't stop following you on Twitter now, Michael. You know,
I think he's listed in anyway, so you purged your soul with him, Michael. So I think he'd be okay, but we've fully acknowledged his worth to Brighton and Albion anyway. So I think this is a fascinating choice you've gone with here. And it's another guy from just up the road from me here. Away you go.
Well, I've chosen Vicente as my midfielder. And to me, personally, he's still the best player to play for Brighton. And that includes the current team. And I know that maybe in a few years' time, if we manage to keep hold of Basuma and Casido, the new Ecuadorian that's getting rave reviews at the moment, then maybe that would change. But in terms of the calibre of the player, just on a different level. And I think for me, I was thinking about this one. I think supporting Brighton through some really, really bad times. You know, and we're like 30 minutes from being kicked out of the Football League in 97. And then in sort of in 2011, to sign a player like Vicente was almost like I've just got a football club back. I've gained a football club almost, because this player is just unbelievable. You know, playing Football Manager and things like that in the noughties, you know, he's always a player. He was always up at the top end of most expensive players to buy. And you think he's playing for my team. But unfortunately, he was ridden with injuries, which is, let's be honest, is why he came to Brighton at the age of 29. If he was a fully fit player, we would never have got him. But, you know, during his career when he was fit, you know, Real Madrid wanted him. Alex Ferguson wanted Man United. Arsene Wenger wanted him at Arsenal. So he was a top, top player. He had like 38 caps for Spain, I think it was. You know, and we talked a minute ago about Gus Poyer being an influence. And I'm sure that Gus Poyer being the manager was one of the reasons why he came to us. And actually, at the end, when he left, he fell out with him massively and called him Poyer one of the most selfish and egocentric people he's ever met in his life. But that's another story. But on the pitch, just different level. When he was fit, you know, I think he announced himself against Ipswich at Portman Road. And I don't know if you've seen that goal. And that's maybe another YouTube klaxon moment here where he gets the ball in his own half and he just keeps running with the ball. And no one tackles him, to be fair. But he then does like a sort of like a Cruyff turn where the defender, you know, he's almost sent for an ice cream out the stand the way he sort of disappears. And he then sort of bends it in the top corner. And we lost that game 3-1. But it's always remembered for that goal and nothing else. He was brilliant against Portsmouth, two goals against Portsmouth. He was, I could talk about him all night. I know we haven't got all night. So he was a fantastic player. But I think the moment that probably cements him with Brighton fans, or definitely with me, was the run and shot that he does against Derby. And when he gets the ball, I think just about on the halfway line, he takes it past about four or five players and he smashes the bar, ball against the bar, sorry. And I still think that bar's shaking today, 10 years later. It would have been one hell of a goal if it went in, and unfortunately it didn't. I don't think Gus Poyer used him enough. How much of that was because of injuries and he wasn't fit, or how much of that was because Poyer was being selfish and egocentric, I don't know. But, you know, we didn't use him in the 2013 playoff semi-final against Palace. How fit he was, I don't know. But even if he was only playing on one leg, surely he would have made a difference. He was that good. Yeah, he was just a great player. And actually, to mention this, he was partly one of the reasons why Bruno signed, because Bruno signed a year after Vicente, and Vicente obviously recommended Bruno to the club, and, well, you know, was there and helped him settle in. So, you know, Vicente also brought Bruno to Brighton, as far as I'm concerned. So that's another little stat there, a little interesting thing.
Yeah. Over here, it's called, forgive my pronunciation, El Puñal de Benicalap, the dagger of Benicalap. Yeah. I mean, an outstanding player. I mean, when he played for Valencia over here, you know, he was a top-notch player. And yet, you know, I can understand why you've picked him. It's a fascinating choice. And I think he only played just a dab over 30 league games for Brighton in his time before he had to pack up. And he, as you say, when he fell out with Poyet at the end, I think he called him something like, he's the worst person I've ever come across in football, or something like that. So Poyet lost the dressing room a little bit there with that guy, I think. So, Aidan, Vicente.
I think everyone loves a skillful winger. I've talked before about the people you can relate to as a fan. A skillful winger is someone you can't relate to at all, because their skills are beyond the rest of us. Usually with pace beyond the rest of us as well, technique and so on, that none of us can match. And that's an appeal in a totally different way, equally valid, of course. And I think being able to do the things that the rest of us can dream of, or can only dream of, sorry, and being able to use that skill to produce great moments for a club, produce goals, to score goals in a way that we can't do, or to come close to scoring goals in the way Michael described with the crossbar rattle. If only that had gone in, there's something pleasing about a shot in off the bar, isn't there? But never mind. We'll just have to settle for the fact it's still wobbling. I think somebody with such outstanding technique and pace and scoring ability as well, it's absolutely fabulous. And obviously, the way the bond forges here is just through sheer ability as much as anything else. I think when he went to Brighton, he was taking a chance as well, but the club, just as much, the club were giving him a chance, you know, a player with injury issues. He played two seasons at Brighton, but, you know, probably only one season's worth of games in all of that, potentially, because they were just both injury interrupted. But I think this is the tale of a player whose ability stands out, shines through, regardless of all the interruptions, stands out amongst the teammates. So even if his contributions were limited in terms of the number of games he played, it was more than made up for in terms of what he was able to do when he was available. So that made any risk that Brighton may have thought they were taking on him more than worthwhile. Then you build on to the less tangible rewards of him being there, as Michael's alluding to there. If he really was instrumental in Bruno arriving, and potentially other Spanish arrivals too, who knows, helping them settle, or using connections, however it worked, that's all to Brighton's benefit as well. And that's just another big tick in the box marked Vicente. So this is a player of a stature that a club like Brighton wouldn't ordinarily get, as Michael said there. It's because of the injuries and because of the toll that had taken on him that Brighton were able to get him. But that, again, that just makes it even better as a story. And that just makes it even more memorable. I'm going down a slight tangent here, but bear with me. In my London years, when I used to go along to Brentford, they were in what is now League One, whatever it happened to be called at the time. And they had an Icelandic international, Herman Hreiðarsson, who was a fantastic player. He was an international player in the third tier of English football. And sure, Iceland, this was before their biggest achievements, but he stood out so much amongst all the other dross at that level. He was just absolutely superb throughout. Every time I saw him, he was just a shining light. He was a defender, but, you know, he kept getting on and scoring all sorts of goals. This is, again, a situation that came about in a totally different way to Vicente, but it's what I'm getting at is the fact that it's somebody who's from levels above playing for a team that has to have taken a chance on them in one way or another. In his case, that was youth and so on. In Vicente's case, it's someone whose career might have just drained away or come to a premature end, and he's given a new lease of life, and he's rewarded Brighton for that chance time and again. And yeah, it's all these characteristics just make you stand out and make you appeal to the fans. Absolutely.
There's something special about a player that you just want the player to get the ball, that player to get the ball, because you think, here we go. And you're going to see something special, something entertaining, something out of the ordinary. And Vicente certainly had that. And I think there's also perhaps a little bit of added magic to the fact that he didn't play that many games, strangely enough, because they're almost special, because you know there weren't that many of them. It's sort of a converse thing to say, but that rarity value, makes these appearance special. And as you mentioned, as you both mentioned, Brighton took a bit of a risk of reward situation when they took Vicente. And I suppose for both of the player and the club, but the talent he displayed, more than paid back for the entertainment he gave to the fans and the joy, the elation that he gave to the fans must have been something special. I know, you know, you look at some players and you think, you know, that they're really, you know, hard working, determined, great. Somebody who has that stardust in his feet, they're something special, Michael, aren't they?
Definitely. No, definitely. So, yeah. Like I said, I'm always speechless to talk about him because to me it was just absolutely magical.
Yeah. Okay, that's great. So, We'll have Vicente up on Mount Rushmore above the Amex, along with Michael Kuipers and Bruno. And we've had the Dutchman and two Spaniards. Your next choice, I know, is going to be an English player. But before we discuss who you've picked as a forward, who came close?
There's two players that came very close. And I've got some other sort of honourable mentions, but these two are really, really close. Depending upon what day of the week it is, it could be any one of these players, if I'm honest. I could change my mind. So the first one, which is just before my time, is Peter Ward. Absolute still club legend. You know, played a major part in getting Brighton Brighton promoted to Division 1 in 79. And, you know, ask anyone who was there at the time, you know, speak to my dad about him. They all rave about him. You know, he lives in America. And, you know, when he comes out and makes guest appearances at the MX, he's treated like royalty. But unfortunately, he's just too young for me. The next obvious one was Bobby Zamora. What a player, you know, to not even choose this one. So, you know, he picked him up at the age of 19 for 100 grand off Bristol Rovers, which at the time is a lot of money, especially for us. At that time, you know, it's absolutely sort of pivotal, the turn of the millennium, getting us promoted. His goals in Division 3 and Division 2 to get us up to the Championship. And some of those goals he scored are absolutely breathtaking. Unfortunately, he got relegated in 2003 and he went to Tottenham. And unfortunately for him, you know, we had him when he was sort of relatively injury-free. And then he was a player that just got injured continuously for the other clubs he played for, West Ham and QPR and Fulham. You know, he played for England as well, of course, didn't he? But I think he would have gone to the 2010 World Cup if it wasn't for injuries. But of course, then he came back in 2015, played one last season, you know, trying to get us to the Premier League. Scored a great last minute winner against Leeds. And I don't know if you guys have done the research on this. And if you have, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it before you. But, you know, that goal was 4,549 days after he scored his last goal for the club. I'm not sure if that's a record, but I think if it's not, it's going to be right up there. Just a great, great player. And I looked at other players who were around when I was first got into football, like Gary Nelson and Mike Small, John Byrne and Gary Hart, which we famously signed for about £1,000 and some kit, I think it was. So they're the ones I went through, and then I'll stop.
I mentioned about Anthony Lockhart and the penalty miss against Leicester and things sticking in your mind. And there's the Brighton player that sticks in my mind for another miss in the Wembley Cup final. Ant Smith must score. That was such a pivotal moment for the club as well. I mean, you know, that was an FA Cup triumph against Manchester United, and sort of slipped away, and obviously things didn't go well in the replay. So yeah, I mean, yeah, you mentioned great Peter Ward. I mean, yeah, what a great goal area poacher this guy was. Scored loads of goals all over the place. Aiden, thoughts?
Yeah, again, obviously the 83 team come to mind, so the Gordon Smith moment is worth a mention. Michael Robinson was obviously part of that team as well, who went on to Liverpool also, and then to Spain, of course, and has become the TV celebrity that he is now in Spain. But I think, yeah, to my mind, and Michael's already talked about it, is Bobby Zamora is the one that I look to if it's not the one that he has picked. You know, two spells, the amount of goals he got in those times. He had a better goal to games ratio for Brighton than he did for any of his other club. Helped them to two successive promotions. So what I'll be really interested to know there is, what is it that's caused Michael's decision to sway towards the player he has picked versus Bobby Zamora? So as well as extolling the virtues of the man you have picked to be chiseled away on Mount Rushmore, I'm intrigued to know the sort of comparative factors that have swayed you away from Zamora. I'm not saying it's a wrong decision, because obviously it's personal, but I think it must have been very, very close. Well, you've alluded to it. Very, very close call, I would think. So I think it's going to be quite an intriguing one to discuss. They've also another one from the past. Sorry, another famous name from the past. Probably didn't have very long there. Dean Saunders, who came through from Brighton. But again, this is going back too far, and he certainly didn't hit the same heights for the club that either Zamora or the one that Michael has picked has done.
Yeah. Did you mention about Michael Robinson? As you know, he was massively popular pundit over here. I mean, he died about 12 months ago. But he worked with one of the TV stations, Movistar, over here doing the commentary. And it's great to hear him talk, because he speaks Spanish like I speak Spanish, very Englishly. And I can understand what he's saying with the other guys too, if it's sort of, you know, 500 miles an hour. But I mean, it's great point. He used to have a TV program over here called, I think it was called The Day Afterwards or something like that. It was like a match of the day thing that analysed football. But rather than sort of having Mark Lawrence on, say this guy's a rubbish defender, that celebrate the skill as he danced past the defender. He was so popular over here. So yeah, I mean, it's interesting the guy he's pick because this guy always seems to perish and score goals against Martin. Regular. And he's been doing it for God knows how many years every time he gets every time in the Premiership he's playing bright. I'm like, oh God, he's playing, he's gonna score. Who is it, Michael?
A bit of a controversial pick perhaps, but I've gone for Glenn Murray. I am, you know, similar in some respects to Bobby Zamora in the sense he had two spells at the club, but you know, we signed him from Rochdale for 300,000 after recommendation from our former manager Barry Lloyd in 2008. You know, he famously suffered from homesickness and there's reports that he fell out with the then manager. He suffered loads of niggly little injuries over those few seasons. And then the last season for us, before he left, before his contract ran out, he was a top goal scorer and we obviously got promoted to the Championship, just ready for to go into the Amex. And he didn't renew his contract. And he, you know, I don't know how true it is, but they said he wanted to go back north and, you know, he ended up at Crystal Palace. So he only ended up 45 miles up the road. So not that far north. You know, we then signed Craig McHale-Smith for £3.5 million, who that season was the top goal scorer in League One. We also signed Will Hoskins for £500,000. I think he banged quite a lot of goals in that season as well. But they both suffered horrendous injuries. But Craig McHale-Smith was not a player that could fit into the way that Gus Poy wanted to play, where Glenn Murray was. So I don't know if it's because he did want to go north or it was because of money. But to me, if we're going to spend £3.5 million on a player, we've got the money to give him the wages. But anyway, but, you know, then again, this is the old sliding doors moment, isn't it? He goes to Palace and scores loads of goals and they get promoted via the playoffs against us. I know he gets injured. I think in the first leg at Selhurst Park, he had a horrific injury. But, you know, he gets Palace promoted. I think he's even scored, you know, goals for Palace quite a few. And then he goes to Bournemouth and gets Bournemouth promoted. And then he comes back to us. And the reason I've gone for him is solely because it's his goals that get us to the Premier League. And, you know, some of the goals along that way are really iconic. And I always think of the Birmingham game where he scores a header in the last minute. And if I listen to that on the commentary on YouTube now, I still get really excited. I know I'm 40 years old and I still get excited about something that happened 6-7 years ago. But anyway, that's just, it's being a football fan, isn't it? It's just what you do. And then, of course, he carried on scoring goals in the Premier League for us. So I think it's the difference between him and Zamora is he got us to the Premier League where Zamora didn't. And he scored the goals in the Premier League when we were there. And the goals against West Ham, he scored. He loved scoring against West Ham.
Scored against us as well.
But it was just, and to be honest, we haven't replaced him up front. I know he was not a player blessed with pace. He was always a player that was very good at holding up the ball, laying it off, and just almost ghosting into the box and being at the right place at the right time and nobody noticing that he'd made that move. Probably more famous maybe on opposition fans for always winning little free kicks by the slightest knock he'd go down and he'd get a free kick in a really good position, buy us a bit of time at the other end of the pitch. Very clever. But I think he was a player that he got better as he got older. Almost like a fine wine. He just got better. One story that I will say about Glenn Murray. I used to work for a large retailer and he used to come shopping in my shop and used to see him quite a few times. But the first time I saw Glenn Murray, I hadn't been on a till for about 13 years. And I sat on it. We had a really big queue. It was really busy. I sat on the till. I looked up and the first customer was Glenn Murray. So I served him at the till and he was playing for Palace at the time. And it was at the time when we started as a country, which we were charging for carrier bags, if you remember. And it was quite a thing. And where I worked, we were told if the customer doesn't want to pay for the carrier bag, you don't have to charge them. But as he played for Palace, and I'm a Brighton fan, I scanned the bag and I charged him the 5p and I didn't ask him. So if Glenn's listening, I owe you 5p.
That's brilliant. Okay. That's a great story. It's really fascinating as you were talking, you have to listen to what I had said. Because Glenn Murray is everything, isn't everything that Bobby Zamora was. You're not quick. not particularly big, not particularly strong, but he just knew how to score goals. He was when you were telling about, you know, his sort of wise football wise, the freshman of mine, he's canny. He understood the game, and he could earn those little free kicks to eat into time, you know, hang on to a lead or whatever. But the amount of times he scored goals where he had this uncanny knack to be where the ball was going to come, like it was a save, and he dropped to his feet rather than defend, or he'd hit the post or something. And I suppose one of those things where, you know, they say about forwards, you always have to gamble. But, you know, I mean, he's got that uncanny knack. And you look at him and you think, well, are you going to score goals? You're not quick, you're not strong. Are you good in the air? Well, okay, you've got a trick and you beat him. Well, probably not so much. But he scored goals, as you say. So it's a fascinating choice. And, you know, whether he was wearing Palace colours or Brighton colours, as I say, he was just perfect scorer against me. So I was going to bat him, but I thought, no, I can't. So, Aidan, Glenn Murray, what do you think, mate?
Yeah, a sterling defence of the decision there from,
yes,
Michael. I fully accept it. Everyone likes a returning hero, and I think that's something that really appeals in this story, particularly one who's been through the lower leagues and then comes back to help them up the top notches as well. I think that's extra appealing. I like the way Michael was describing there. His goals got us to the Premier League, and then he was scoring in the Premier League for the club as well. These are the memories that you latch onto. If his goals are the ones that got Brighton there more so than anybody else's, then a lot of those significant moments that come to mind will be Glenn Murray. It won't be anybody else. And that's sort of priceless when it comes to fan memories, fan connections. So, you know, perfect explanation of why Glenn Murray is the choice, not anybody else and not Zamora. It's those extra little bits that came in there. So no, fully on board. I'll get my own chisel out and start going on this one.
I mean, it's interesting because normally we say with much more, it tends to be just the head or the head and shoulders. But I think I might need to make an exception with Glenn Murray because I've got to get his carrier bag in as well. I might have to do sort of with an arm up as well, holding his carrier bag or a 5p piece. He's saying you still owe him, Michael. So every time you look above the Amex and on Brighton's Mount Rushmore, and you see Ben looking down at you, you think, I owe you 5p, Tiger.
Just to add to the description of Murray versus Zamora, of course, Glenn Murray, he's scored more goals for Brighton as well, and he's the second in their all-time scorers list, only behind somebody from the 1920s, Tommy Cook, which is obviously a totally different era of goal scoring and so on. So very much so in the modern age, Glenn Murray is Brighton's best ever goal scorer. So Bobby Zamora, by the way, is in sick. Way off.
Right, so we've got the Mount Rushmore four all sorted. So the goalkeeper, we've got Michelle Kuypers, I should say. Defender Bruno, midfielder Vicente, and the striker Glenn Murray. So the only question left to ask you now, Michael, is if I said to you, who is Mr. Brighton Old Albion, who would you say? Now, it can be one of the four players you picked. It can be somebody else entirely, another player if you want to. Who's Mr. Brighton Old Albion for you?
And I'm going to stick with the four I've chosen, or from within those four, and I'm going to go with Bruno, just for on the pitch, off the pitch, the mural in the lanes, which, you know, I work not far from there. So it's got to be Bruno. And I love the way that we were talking about the fact that he's come over to a different country. He's adopted Brighton as his home. He's embraced everything about the club, the city, the people. So I'm going for Bruno.
I think that's a great choice. Aidan, any thoughts on any other dissenting thoughts, should I say?
Well, you know, after this whole Glenn Murray chat, I was tempted to go for him, but but Michael's just swung me the other way now, and remembering all the chat about what we talked about Bruno, and it's the connection to the place and the people that swing it for me. So not only a connection to the club and what he'd done for the club or continues to do for the club, it's those extra bonds and the connection to the people and the place. So yeah, spot on, Vicente. Sorry, Bruno for me. wrong Spaniard. God. Bruno.
Yes, Bruno, Mr. Brighton Old Albion from Michael's choices. So that was Matt Rushmore, Brighton Old Albion's version. So massive thanks to Michael for coming on and discussing it with us and giving us his choices and explaining them and convincing Aidan where he was going wrong. Guiding back onto the path of righteousness. So thanks very much, Michael. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely loved it. It's been fantastic. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thanks for coming. It's always great when people thank us coming on. You know, without guests, this just wouldn't work. So you've been a great guest, Michael. I had fun.
Oh, absolutely. I am thoroughly educated in the ways of Glenn Murray, and I will never make these mistakes again.
Every day is a school day, mate.
But no, it's been absolutely terrific. Another great pod, another great guest. Fantastic to chat about a club who are doing very, very well these days, and one that most neutrals are quite happy to see do so.
Indeed so. So thanks to the listeners for listening to Mount Rushmore, and catch us next time on the LOB podcast from These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on the LOB, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.